It is the morning show. I'm K. Dr. Kent. Now we look at projects dedicated to funding climate adaptation and resilience. The Wildlife Conservation Society, it has a fund that's supporting 123 climate adaptation project grants in the lower 48, including here in Wisconsin. Join in on this work of helping wildlife and ecosystems adapt to different climate impacts. 800-642-1234. Conversation is right here. 800-642-1234. Liz Tully is Climate Adaptation Fund Associate Director at the Wildlife Conservation Society. Liz, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. I'm so glad you guys are talking about adaptation on your show.
Yes. Well, let's start here in Wisconsin. And the newest site working toward climate adaptation is this Rush Creek State Natural Area that is near La Crosse, one of the largest prairies in the Midwest, nearly 50 rare declining species. What is being done there?
This is a wonderful partnership with the Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin. But a few others, including your state DNR, Department of Natural Resources, and the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts. So, as you said, this is serving over 50 species of greatest conservation need and one of the largest remaining prairies of its kind in the whole Midwest. They're trying to work on addressing the increasing temperatures and the precipitation patterns that they're seeing that are pretty extreme and leading to severe flooding. So to address all those challenges, the conditions for their normal conservation approaches are just different now. So now they're working on reconnecting these remnant dry prairies and restoring the oak savanna and the woodlands by removing invasive species. That is a major adaptation strategy. They're also applying prescribed fire. They'll convert cropland back into native prairie and savanna by using climate-adaptive seed species and genotypes, another important adaptation strategy. And overall, this will lead to a much more connected, resilient habitat for hundreds of wildlife and plant species, while also, because of the grassland, carbon sequestration will provide carbon mitigation benefits.
How are these tactics and this work in climate adaptation, how is that different from conservation work historically?
I love this question because it's not so on the ground. It doesn't look that different. We're planting plants and trees. These partners are. They're doing prescribed fires. They're removing invasives, all standard conservation actions. What's different is they are adjusting the actions and the species based on the new and projected climate impacts they're seeing at this area. So it's a wonderful combination of standard conservation science, but new climate science, new vulnerability analyses, and we really combine local knowledge. Science is almost a little too slow for climate change. So these projects are very hyper-local and really rely on people who have lived and worked in these landscapes for many years and decades.
Oh, that's really interesting. And so as you look to figure out where to put these grants, you really are looking closely at that local knowledge, as you call it, people who know this land intimately.
Absolutely.
When the Rush Creek State Natural Area, its adaptation plan includes climate-adapted species of plants, can you give an example of how plant species can adapt to climate change, how that is actually possible?
So plant species adapt very slowly, much slower than the rate of climate change impacts. So a lot of these projects are actually sourcing seeds from other regions that have already experienced the climate conditions they're seeing now or expecting to see. So they're going to source them from areas that are drier. If this part of this area of Rush Creek now might be seeing periods of dryness, but they're also seeing periods of increased wetness. So they're actually going to increase the types of species they're going to plant so that there are more species available and thriving during different parts of the year. It's a multiple kind of multi-pronged strategy with sourcing from regions that already experience those climate conditions, but also increasing the species variety.
I want to move to the Lakeshore Natural Resource Partnership, working with the communities of northeast and east central Wisconsin and the waters that drain into Lake Michigan. And this is interesting because it's finding that tricky balance between native plants and the transient visitors. How do you consider climate adaptation for year-round species versus the migratory species?
So that's a really common issue that a lot of our projects address. There are these resident bird species and wildlife species, but then out here on the coast of Lake Michigan, this is where you guys are under this amazing Lake Michigan flyway. So there's a lot of migratory birds being served, and that does change the species and the habitat types that will need to be managed or assisted to persist through climate change. What's interesting here is that there's a lot of diverse habitats that serve both the resident and the migratory species. There's forests, there's riparian habitats, there's coastal estuarine here, and cold water streams. So that's part of the strategy is choosing a site that already presents the potential or existing diversity and mix of habitats and food species availability and managing them. One thing that's interesting here is because of the climate challenges, which are very similar to those being faced at the Rush Creek site, on the lakeshore, this is changing migratory patterns. They're shifting. The arrivals of these birds are earlier in the spring, and the departures are later in the fall. And that presents a mismatch of food availability for those species across that longer timeline. So this project is changing the plant species and habitat cover that are available.
Liz Tully with the Wildlife Conservation Society leading its Climate Adaptation Fund. Join in 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show. We continue this conversation ahead on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about the Wildlife Conservation Society and a new round of grant making earlier this year through its Climate Adaptation Fund. You can join in on this work, 800-642-1234. Liz Tully is here with the Wildlife Conservation Society. Liz, take us to this climate adaptation plan in Florence County. So Wildlife Conservation Society awarded a $140,000 grant back in 2014. What are the changes that have been seen to the scrub oak forests there?
Yeah, so this project, this was the first project in Wisconsin that we were able to fund and learn from. They were working on climate-driven drought specifically in this area, but then the pressures from that drought led to an increase in forest pests and disease, like oak wilt and the jack pine budworm. So the combination of drought and stressors were also expected to intensify. They had to do something different about the way they're managing this forest and this habitat and dealing with erosion. The forests in this part of the state provide habitat for approximately 18 bird species and 9 mammal species, all of greatest conservation need. And they put in a mosaic of small red pine plantations in areas. This actually was meant to break up this mono species of jack pine, which is much more vulnerable to that jack pine budworm. And those little mini plantations they put in between would buffer the area against outbreaks of insects or other disease that would target specific species. Sometimes adaptation involves diversifying the species you're working with so the whole system can respond and bounce back, and only small parts of it are vulnerable to new outbreaks.
A bit of trial and error as well.
Oh yeah. So I like to say adaptation is something that's meant for those who can be agile and patient. It's not quick or formulaic work. It's very place-based, and you have to kind of approach the science you know with a lot of humility and I would even say wisdom. And it requires very contemplative acts. And you have to adhere to logic as well while still being flexible. Because the climate conditions are the certainty around what they are kind of shifting beneath our feet sometimes.
I'm thinking about over 100 grant awards and wondering what are the challenges in climate finance, if you will, in green lighting climate adaptation grant projects from a fiscal standpoint.
Yeah, I mean, I think the challenge is that adaptation is still new. We have been fortunate to have a wonderful funder, the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, funding this program with WCS, the Wildlife Conservation Society, for over 10 years. So we have managed to create a set of frameworks, criteria, and standards for assessing and greenlighting pretty well vetted, well planned adaptation projects. And I think the exciting thing will be how do we export that out once funding becomes available for adaptation. How do we transfer over what we've learned, because it does take a certain set of criteria that are different from the typical conservation project to be able to green light with confidence funding for adaptation.
And it's tricky too, because you have public interests and private interests. You have just other funding streams as well, and that it really sounds like it has to be a lot of collaboration.
Oh yeah, you really get this work. They're all partnerships as well. That's one of the most important, that's one of the criteria we have, is the quality of partnerships. And a lot of them are public and private partnerships. There are wonderful state partners on these projects. There are even federal partners sometimes. There's city and other municipality partners with conservation nonprofits and private landowners.
Liz, thank you for this work and thank you for joining us.
Yeah, I'm so glad again that you featured adaptation. It's part of the climate crisis that's not happening in the atmosphere, which is very important, but it's also the part that's happening on the ground here.
Liz Tully is Climate Adaptation Fund Associate Director at the Wildlife Conservation Society. Ahead this hour, it's the work to help prevent the spread of invasive carp invading the Great Lakes, along with your questions, what's working, what's not, 800-642-1234. News update is next on the IDS Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Over the years, so much trial and error on how to prevent invasive species from reaching the Great Lakes. Thinking about those underwater speakers, the electric barriers, the air bubble curtains. Invasive carp have the potential to decimate the region's $7 billion a year fishing industry. Join in, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org to join the conversation. Mark Fritz is a fish biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the La Crosse Fish and Wildlife Conservation Office. Mark, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Hi, Amy McGovern here as well, Aquatic Invasive Species Program Supervisor for the Midwest Region of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Amy, welcome to you.
Good morning.
Good morning. There has been, Amy, decades of work, as you know, to prevent invasive carp from breaching the Great Lakes, you know, trapping and blocking and all of these things. And, you know, researchers do think that the threat to Lake Michigan is greater than previously thought. What is the mitigation strategy as you see it for the Great Lakes?
Well, good morning. Thank you. I think that the first thing to note is that we haven't, we have a lot of surveillance efforts going on with state and federal partners in the Illinois River. We really haven't seen that population front move in the last decade. So they're still about 40 to 50 miles from Lake Michigan, which tells us that a lot of the removal efforts that we're doing to control the species where they're most dense, like commercial fishing and promoting the removal of fish, is keeping them sort of where we want them, which is away from Lake Michigan. And we're continuing to work with the state of Illinois and other partners, again, to just make sure that we monitor that population very closely throughout the year using the traditional gears, like you've mentioned, commercial fishing, removing those fish from the system completely, and using new technologies like environmental DNA to see if we have evidence of the fish in waters where we haven't found a lot of them. So we're using those multiple techniques and tools to make sure that we have a really close surveillance of the system. And so far, so good.
Well, that's interesting. It sounds like their non-progression, their status quo is a positive thing.
It is. It is. And I think that we put a lot of effort on the water into making sure that we know where that population is. And so I think that we certainly couldn't fall back on the efforts that we have right now to be on the water and conduct that surveillance. And also removing those fish is a huge control to their tool there. The state of Illinois supports programs, and they remove 1 million pounds of fish every year. So that is a key effort in this whole integrated effort to control them and keep them at bay.
Wow, 1 million pounds of fish. Mark, you monitor the Upper Mississippi River. Carp like to congregate in different areas depending on time of year. What are you seeing on the Mississippi?
Well, we have a range of different population densities that we see on the Upper Mississippi River here in Wisconsin, along the Upper Mississippi, along the Wisconsin-Minnesota border. That region is a fairly sparse population. We see a smattering of adults that come into the region. As you go further downstream, the population increases in density. And when we start to get down on the border of Missouri, that's when we begin to see reproductive populations. So at this point in time, we are confident that we only have a small population here in Wisconsin.
Amy, can you step back for a moment? Remind us, how did they end up here and why are they so harmful to our waters?
A good question. Why are we here, right? They were originally imported from Southeast Asia to the southern United States to really help aquaculture and wastewater treatment facilities to keep those retention ponds clean. And like a lot of other invasive species, you don't anticipate the the flooding that might happen there, the accidental releases. Really allow these fish to escape into the Mississippi River system and migrate into the Missouri and the Illinois rivers. So they're bad because they are prolific feeders. They eat a lot, and that in turn outcompetes native fish for food. And they have a lot of babies. They can produce a lot of eggs. They can move long distances, and as a lot of us know, and we've seen the videos on YouTube, they can also jump out of the water.
Mm-hmm.
That's one species. The silver carp is that one species that can jump out of the water, and that poses a safety hazard to recreational boaters as well.
Amy McGovern, Aquatic Invasive Species Program Supervisor for the Midwest Region of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Mark Fritz with us as well, fish biologist based in La Crosse, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. You can join in on invasive carp, what you want to know, what you've seen that you think will work to keep them at bay, 800-642-1234. So, Mark, our efforts in the Mississippi River and the patterns you see there with the carp, can that inform how you approach what could be done for mitigation in the Great Lakes or elsewhere? What can the Mississippi tell us?
Yes, we always try to ensure that we have an active communication network between our teams who manage invasive carp in different areas of the country. We want to share best practices wherever possible and enhance the management through our different lessons learned. The population on the Upper Mississippi River is well studied. We take every bit of information we can from every fish we catch. We look at things like their length and their weight and their age, sex distributions. And we use advanced quantitative methods like models that help us predict how those populations have come to be, how they're going to change over time, and how those populations might respond to specific management actions like removing more fish or removing fewer fish or putting in barriers that might slow their movement.
Sounds like data is king here.
Yes, ma'am. It's the name of the game. It's what we do. We as scientists, as field scientists here on the UMR, that's our primary duty. We go out and collect as much information as we possibly can, and then we pass that information on to decision makers like Amy.
Amy, you mentioned earlier environmental DNA. What are some newer ways being used to deter invasive carp from spreading?
A good question. We have, I think, a great opportunity right now. We're doing field tests of new technologies at two different sites to test underwater sound, which is really interesting, as a deterrent for invasive carp. And one of the sites is closer to Mark there on the Upper Mississippi River in Keokuk, Iowa at Lock and Dam 19. And the other site that it's being tested is at Barkley Dam in Grand Rivers, Kentucky, on the Tennessee River. And these sites basically are unique sites where we have a pinch point in the system, you could say, that fish are getting through the lock structures and up into the next pool of the river, but water doesn't get over the dam. So you have one spot where they can go through, and there we're installing aquatic underwater sound devices on the river bottom that project sound into an area to deter fish. And in the case of the system in Kentucky, it also includes a bubble curtain. So we're tagging fish in these areas and seeing how they respond behaviorally, as well as native fish. We want to make sure that we know how and understand how these systems affect native fish as well. But the idea is to block their passage if we can.
For a while, the scientists were looking into these bio bullets, or these encapsulated fish poison that break down in the gut of the carp and kill it. What has happened on that front? How are how effective are bio-based control products?
Still, research is being done on those. I think there's a little bit less acceptance of those until we really have all the information right when you're putting something like that into the system. We are always thinking about the native fish population and how these various control mechanisms affect those native fish. So the research is ongoing for that. More focus, I would say, on the technology for the deterrence, including the sound, and also carbon dioxide is another technology that's being tested at certain locks to deter fish.
So sound and carbon dioxide. Mark, what technology do you think might work for where you are and work on the Mississippi?
Well, those technologies that Amy described seem to be fairly applicable to any space where we have carp. One of the incredible things is that scientists have been able to tune those technologies to have effects specifically on carp and to minimize the effects on native species. So there's a good chance that what we're learning in Kentucky can be directly applied to the UMR as well. So I'm very hopeful that the deterrence technologies combined with our other efforts like fish removal will have a lasting impact on the populations here.
Amy, how about you? Are you hopeful that the Great Lakes will be preserved here and not be invaded?
Absolutely. I think you have to think that way. We have a wonderful partnership, and Mark alluded to the communication across partners, state, federal boundaries. It's one big system, and we're working together to control carp, and I am very optimistic, yes.
Well, Amy and Mark, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Amy McGovern is Aquatic Invasive Species Program Supervisor for the Midwest Region of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Mark Fritz there, fish biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the La Crosse Fish and Wildlife Conservation Office. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.